the coup and control of the capital. The Cossack regiment, which arrived at Tehran walls 3 days earlier, entered the capital on February 21, 1921, without resistance. The ranking Iranian gendarme officers were willing participants, and the Tehran police force, led by a Swedish chief, immediately surrendered. The Cossack troops were stationed in Meydan near Mashq, Drill Square, and in the early morning hours of the same day, they began to round up high-ranking Qajar statesmen and notables. Soon, similar arrests were followed in the provinces. By the end of Seyed Ziya's government some 3 months later, nearly 500 officials were in government custody. The detentions and house arrests, a joint initiative of Seyed Ziya and Reza Khan, were meant to emphasize the revolutionary character of the coup, presumably to counter the socialist propaganda of the Jangilis, but also to scare the ruling elite and perhaps even extort from them the assets they were accused of amassing through corruption and nepotism. All telegraph, telephone, and road communications with the provinces were temporarily cut off and key government offices taken over. 3 days later, the vexed Ahmad Shah, sufficiently intimidated by the coup organizers and persuaded by the British minister as well as by his own advisers and courtiers, issued a decree appointing Seyed Ziya Prime Minister with full authority. His appointment registered a significant shift, for it was the first made from outside the circles of the Qajar elite, anticipating a new era of middle-class politics. In Reza Khan's second communique, 2 days later, possibly penned by Seyed Ziya, Reza Khan assumed the title of Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. There, he made it abundantly clear that he entertained ambitions beyond mere leadership of the Cossack division. The tone was indignant, underscoring the Cossack forces' suffering and highlighting the troops' wounded honour and depravity. But there was nothing that amounted to a programme of reform, just an early taste of an autocrat in the making. The reform programme came through, however, in Seyed Ziya's first communique on February the 26th. It was a manifesto of sorts, aiming to justify the coup as a last resort to save the country from corrupt and inept statesmen who for the previous 15 years had betrayed the constitutional revolution and the sacrifices made by the people. Yet it made no reference to the fourth Majlis, which at the time was yet to be convened. Instead, Seyed Ziya called for the downfall of the landowning and aristocratic elite who long sapped the nation of its riches. "Destiny called on me," he declared, "to save the country and the monarchy from these predators by relying on the loyal armed forces to shoulder his sacred duty and end misery and insecurity." The communique further called for measures to stop corruption and bureaucratic inefficiency, to promote reliance on domestic income in order to improve national security and the standard of living of working people, and to overhaul the dysfunctional judiciary. He also highlighted the need for greater social justice through land reform and distribution to the peasants, the crown and state lands, and called for an end to the chaos in the government's finances. He further called for the promotion of a spirit of patriotism and national pride, and promised modern schools for children of all classes, growth of trade and industry, a campaign against high inflation and racketeering, a better communication network, urban amenities, and the beautification of the capital. On the sensitive question of foreign policy, Seyed Ziya promised peace and coexistence with all neighbours, but called for an end to the capitulatory rights of the so-called most favoured nations, the discriminatory extraterritorial privileges extended to foreign subjects as early as the 1828 Treaty of Turkmenchay. Shortly thereafter, in another statement, he renounced the 1919 Anglo-Persian Agreement, although for all intents and purposes it was already dead. Praise for British assistance in Iran over the past century, as well as for the Iranians' loyalty toward Britain, were other predictable features of the communique, as was Ziya's hope that revoking the 1919 agreement would remedy the misunderstanding between the two nations. With minor variations, Seyed Ziya's programme followed a course already set out by the governments of Assagh al-Dowle and later Mashir al-Dowle, and it served as a blueprint for the forthcoming Pahlavi reforms. As an important counterbalance, The new regime also announced the conclusion of a friendship treaty with the newly established Soviet Union. Although in 1918 Iran was among the first countries to recognize the Bolshevik regime, the signing of the treaty in Moscow actually took place on February 26, 1921, 5 days after the coup in Tehran. As early as 1919, Vasug al-Dowleh and his successors in office, Ali Goli Ansari Moshaver al-Mamalek, who had negotiated the treaty, realized the value of normalizing relations with the Soviets. Like the abrogation of the 1919 agreement, the signing of the 1921 agreement with the Soviet Union further vindicated a return to Iran's traditional buffer position. The 26-article treaty, which remained in effect until the early days of the Islamic Republic, reaffirmed the Soviets' renunciation of Russian imperial concessions, economic interests, and unpaid loans. It recognized Iran's full sovereignty, called for non-intervention in internal affairs, recognized existing boundaries, and called for resolving border disputes through negotiation. In return, the treaty stipulated a unique concession to the Soviet Union: the right to intervene militarily in Iran in the case Iran was threatened by a third party, in effect reaffirming the conduct of Tsarist Russia since 1909. In a reference to Britain and its anti-Bolshevik policy, Article 6 stipulated the following: if a third party should attempt to carry out a policy of usurpation by means of armed intervention in Persia, or if such power should desire to use Persian territory as a base of operation against Russia, and if the Persian government should not be able to put a stop to such menace, Russia shall have the right to advance her troops into the Persian interior for the purpose of carrying out the military operation necessary for its defiance. Moscow's further clarification in December 1921, defining the contingencies for any military intervention and confirming the Bolsheviks' evacuation from Gilan, persuaded Iran to ratify the treaty. The initiative demonstrated a certain degree of agency on the Iranian side, even at a time of great turmoil and uncertainty. Whether the conclusion of the treaty was also a motivation for British support for the coup is a matter of debate. What is clear, however, and important for the future of Iran, was that by the end of 1920, what we might call Iran's Wilsonian moment, a new equilibrium between the two powers began to emerge that allowed Iran to join the League of Nations and enjoy a period of relative freedom in its foreign affairs. Seyed Ziya's critics almost instantaneously labelled his government as divorcer, mahalel, and the Black Cabinet. Its 100-day term, nevertheless, was a major shift, for it relied on a coup by a populist British proxy and a Cossack officer to implement a course very different from Curzon's vision to incorporate Iran into the British colonial sphere. The move cost Norman his career. The seasoned diplomat who knew Arabic and Turkish and earlier had served in Cairo and Istanbul and then at the Paris Peace Conference grasped the depth of Iranian resentment toward British designs better than his superior. Curzon, who called him back from Tehran after only 16 months, refused to meet with him, and soon after Norman was forced to retire at the age of 52. Reza Khan as the Commander-in-Chief. If Seyed Ziya's time would soon come to pass, Reza Khan's would not. His rise between 1921 and 1925, culminating in his ascent to the throne and the founding of the Pahlavi dynasty, brought to power a new military elite, co-opted some Qajar notables but marginalized the rest, crushed the Janjal movement and other centers of autonomy and secession, bulldozed through a state-sponsored program of secular reforms, and pacified the countryside with ruthless efficiency. It was as if a surgical knife had lanced an infested cyst that had long troubled Iran's body politic. At the outset, the measures implemented by the new strongman of Iran were welcomed by nationalists and left-leaning Democrats alike. But once the autocratic nature of his regime became more apparent, support began to evaporate. Reza Khan and his close circle showed little hesitation to force into silence these independent political and religious voices as long as they could secure the backing of the growing class of professionals, modernist intellectuals, and even a generation of mullahs who exchanged their clerical garb and turban in exchange for European attire. These new sectors laid the foundation for the secular middle class that would form the backbone of Pahlavi Iran. Resolute and calculative, Reza Khan, by then known by his new military title Sardar Sepah, Chief of the Army, proved a quick study and a shrewd manoeuvrer. Giving the cold shoulder to Seyed Ziaur from the start, even though at times they appeared to be in the same camp, within a year he consolidated his hold over the Cossack division and its officer corps, some of whom were senior to him, and merged it with the Iranian gendarmerie, the police, and Iran's regular troops. 2 months after the coup, when he assumed the position of Minister of War, he was widely recognized as Iran's savior and treated accordingly. Reza Khan was a figure reminiscent of Nader in 1732, when he elevated himself to the position of Safavid regent. Ahmad Shah was not yet completely ostracized, nor was Reza Khan the absolute master of the political stage, but the grounds were well prepared for the rise of a new autocracy. Seyed Ziaur's political fall happened as fast as his meteoric rise. Once he had aroused enough resentment among the Qajar elite and lost both the confidence of the British and his usefulness to Reza Khan, he was forced into exile in Palestine under British mandate, where he would remain for 2 decades. Iran's new master soon realized that collaboration with select members of the Qajar elite and landed aristocracy was more advantageous than working with a rabble-rousing journalist tarnished by his close association with the British. Soon he began to see the merits of having on his side the likes of Ahmad Gavam al-Sultaneh, later Ahmad Gavam, 1873-1955, Vasag al-Doleh's younger brother Hassan Mushir al-Doleh, and Hassan Mustafi al-Mamalek, members of the old guard who were popular with the intelligentsia. The situation on the ground also helped lift Reza Khan's stature. The withdrawal of the British Norpor force in May 1921 coincided with Bolshevik disengagement from the Jangyal movement and the subsequent withdrawal of the Red Army from Gilan. The rapid end to military occupation, 3 years after the end of the war, in turn created a power vacuum. For one, the British envoy in Tehran and his superiors acknowledged that Britain no longer wielded the kind of military presence that could dictate its wishes to the rising Reza Khan, whom Norman had characterized as a peasant upstart. It seemed as though overnight British prestige had suffered a setback. Yet Reza Khan's ascendancy was not achieved without serious domestic challenges. A senior gendarme officer in Khorasan, Colonel Mahamad Taghi Khan, better known as Pessian, 1891-1921, staged what eventually turned into a full-scale revolt against Tehran. A Germanophile romantic, Pessian had earlier served as Kermanshah military commander during the provisional government in exile before escaping to Berlin. After his return as military commander of Khorasan in February 1921, he was instrumental in the arrest of Gavam al-Sultaneh, which brought him the blessing of a handful of Mashhad notables and the loyalty of subordinate gendarme officers. Wary of Reza Khan's rapid rise, he chose to resist a merger with the Cossack division, and upon Gavam's appointment to premiership, the colonel, resentful of a return to elite politics, resisted disarmament. In October 1921, he died in clashes with government forces, and the Khorasan rebellion collapsed soon thereafter. Throughout mid-1921, Reza Khan and his troops also scored a final victory against the Jangyal movement, the greatest challenge to the Tehran government. After the withdrawal of Soviet forces, the divided Jangyal movement rapidly disintegrated. Even mediation by the legendary revolutionary Haydar Khan Amu Oghlu could not heal the ideological and personal divisions. After his exile from Iran in 1910, Haydar Khan had spent several years in Europe, including Germany, and during the war years he organized a socialist brigade to fight the Allies alongside the Young Turks in northern Iraq. The Bolshevik Revolution boosted Haydar's morale. Close to Russian revolutionaries and known to Lenin, he was dispatched by the Bolsheviks first to Central Asia to fight against the Russian whites. In the mid-1920s, during the famous Baku Congress, he won the leadership of the Iranian-dominated Adalat party that had been initiated in 1916. In mid-1921, after the coup in Tehran, he moved from Baku to Gilan to mediate between Jangiel's rival factions. Eshanallah Khan and his fighters from the Caucasus opted to first fight it out against government forces, but under pressure from the newly appointed Soviet representative in Tehran, Theodor Rothstein, who was anxious to normalize relations with the Iranian central government, they later were forced to leave for Baku with the evacuating Bolsheviks. In Eshanallah's absence, Haydar Khan saw an opportunity to fill the gap, possibly with Rothstein's support. He persuaded Kerchak Khan in August 1921 to appoint him as Commissar of Foreign Affairs for the Gilan Soviet Republic. Soon after, however, Kerchak Khan's supporters assassinated Haydar Khan in October 1921 because of suspicions that he favoured Soviet conciliation toward Tehran. From his beginnings as a socialist agitator in 1907 to a mediator in the forests of Gilan, Haydar Khan left behind a legacy of violent radicalism and often futile agitation that has since been glamorized by generations of Iranians on the left. Eshanallah's end was no less tragic. He spent the rest of his life in Baku, where he reportedly was arrested in 1937 and killed in one of Stalin's purges. Haydar's fall anticipated the final collapse of the Jangiel movement. With Reza Khan himself leading the troops to recapture Rasht, Kerchak Khan retreated back into the forests. Once his war commissar, leader of a Kurdish affiliate of the Jangiel movement, surrendered to Reza Khan, Kerchak and a small band of his loyal disciples took to the high mountains of the Khalkhal region west of the Caspian. In October 1921, Kerchak Khan and a German junior officer and friend who had remained loyal to him through the years died of exposure, perhaps trying to reach Russian Azerbaijan. The defeat of the Jangiel movement signified the end of a socialist anti-imperialist tendency in Iran. Rooted in the constitutional revolution, the Jangiel movement thrived in its aftermath, but lost out to a centralizing state that relied on a superior military aimed to implement a secular state-building project. In January 1922, when another gendarme officer, Abul Ghassem Lahouti, 1887-1957, a socialist revolutionary and poet, rose in the rebellion and briefly captured Tabriz, he was quickly besieged and forced to defect to the Soviet Union. Lahouti's attempt was fueled by secessionist tendencies in Iranian Azerbaijan. Less than 2 years earlier, an urban uprising led by a clergyman, Mohammad Khiabani, 1880-1920, another Azerbaijani nationalist with socialist leanings, had been put down by the Governor-General Mahdi Goli Khan Hedayat Mohber al-Saltaneh. Khiabani also died under suspicious circumstances. Contrary to Azerbaijan's Iran-centered nationalism throughout the constitutional period, and despite the fact that Azerbaijanis acted as the engine for that revolution, both the Khiabani and Lahouti revolts pointed at an emerging ethnic resentment which would pan out in a generation during the post-World War II Azerbaijan secessionist crisis. There was no question that Azerbaijan had a distinct ethno-linguistic identity, and the Persian-centric nationalism dictated from Tehran did not go over well with Azerbaijanis or other Turkish-speaking populations, who constituted perhaps a quarter of Iran's population. Yet one cannot ignore such ideological threads that tied these sentiments to the pan-Turkism of the Young Turks era and later to the Bolshevik-inspired propaganda of Soviet Azerbaijan. Reza Khan's military not only curtailed the Jangiel movement and wiped out the nationalist Islamic idealism embedded in it, but also crushed nearly all sources of tribal resistance to the centralizing state. There were repeated crackdowns between 1921 and 1931 on the Kurds in the northwest, Boyer Ahmad, and other Mamasani tribes of Luristan province, the Shahseven of Azerbaijan, the Gashgais of Fars, and the Bakhtayaris of Isfahan. Employing heavy weaponry as well as air bombardment, the notorious Western Division of the reorganized Iranian army, headed by Reza Khan's senior officers, pummeled the lightly armed tribal forces. Soon after victory over Jangiel, the Iranian army raided the rebellious chief of the Kurdish Shakak tribe, Ismail Aga Simku, Semitku, who had long wreaked havoc in western Azerbaijan, looting Christian villages and killing the inhabitants. With the blessing of the retreating Ottoman army, in 1918, Simku massacred several hundred Assyrians and committed other atrocities. He wished to unite into a Kurdish republic the Kurdish tribes on both sides of the Iran-Ottoman border, though he never truly succeeded crossing over the line from bandit to political leader. In the summer of 1922, Iranian forces drove Simku across the Ottoman border and captured his fortress in Cherri in the Salmas region. The pro-Reza Khan press celebrated the defeat of the Shakak as a major victory, although it took another 8 years of clashes before Simku would die in skirmishes with the Iranian army. Insurrections aside, major sources of resistance in tribal regions were against the state's relentless tax collection and various forms of extortion by army officers. Moreover, the weakening of Iran's political center, especially since the start of World War I, had encouraged regional autonomy along the periphery, which at times benefited from real or potential economic opportunities. Later on, the state's policy to make nomadic communities sedentary, profoundly disruptive to the nomadic way of life, triggered revolts. For Tehran, as for any modern centralizing state, nomads were a potential threat, for they constituted a population difficult to control, especially if armed and in command of their terrain. The amalgamated armed forces, further consolidated by the merger of the South Persian Rifles in September 1921, were reorganized into four divisions, with central command firmly in Reza Khan's hand. Taking advantage of the prolonged martial law that had been in place since the beginning of the coup, a small group of army officers, perhaps no more than two dozen, became masters of the country, ruling with impunity as military governors over provinces and cities. In their new uniforms, shiny riding boots, rimmed caps, and fancy accoutrements, they instilled in the heart of ordinary Iranians fear and hatred, but also admiration. For many officers, a violent demeanor and disdain toward the general public were considered natural and necessary. Peasants, nomads, and urbanites had to pay tribute to officers with flattery, cash, and gifts, or else face grave repercussions. Appropriation of land and property, summary executions, cruel public punishments, and severe beatings of civilians and troops were accepted norms of this military culture. A facade of discipline and efficiency held by officers of all ranks was complemented by military pride and loyalty to the new commander-in-chief. The military became a new moneyed class with an appetite for luxury, leisure, and promiscuity. The funds for military modernization, recruitment, and campaigns were secured by appropriating indirect taxes and state income from the crown lands. Reza Khan attached both departments to the Ministry of War. Soon, a large chunk of the back payments from the country's share of the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, nearly £1 million, $5 million, negotiated earlier by Vossag al-Dowle, was also appropriated. This shot in the arm made military expenditures the largest item in the budget and a burden for still ailing state finances. Attempts by statesmen like Mohammad Mossadegh al-Saltaneh, then Minister of Finance in Gavam al-Saltaneh's first cabinet, to negotiate a fair budgetary deal with Reza Khan ended in frustrating deadlocks, and Mossadegh resigned in protest in January 1922. It was apparent that the Qajar statesmen had lost to the military upstart. Coercion and the call for a republic. By October 1922, a bread shortage in the capital resulting from the army's misuse of the state's wheat monopoly brought the public to Baharistan Square in front of the Majlis, which had been in session since July 1921. With women at the forefront protesting the shortages, this act of public discontent ended in a violent showdown with security forces. The opposition newspapers and a handful of deputies of the Majlis, notably Hassan Mudares, criticized Reza Khan and his military machine for mishandling the demonstration and misappropriating funds. Gradually, a unified opposition, timid though it appeared at first, began to take shape. The parliamentary minority was backed outside the majlis by a handful of journalists and intellectuals, middle-ranking clergy in Tehran and elsewhere, a few tribal chiefs, discontented merchants of the bazaar, and elements of the Qajar court and aristocracy buoyed by the Prince Regent Muhammad Hassan Mirza, 1899-1943. After Ahmad Shah departed for Europe, an exile from which he never returned, the Shah's younger brother became the focus of Qajar solidarity. As the Prince Regent, he symbolized the last bastion of resistance against Reza Khan and all that he and his supporters stood for. By autumn 1922, the anti-Reza Khan coalition was able to put a temporary halt to the otherwise irrepressible rise of the commander-in-chief. Reza Khan was unprepared for a showdown and politically did not feel confident enough to oust the old regime. Reza Khan's performance as a military commander and a political operator nevertheless earned grudging praise not only from the new British minister Percy Lorraine, but also from the Soviet minister Theodor Rothstein, who, after his arrival, comfortably slipped into the role of a Russian diplomatic counterweight to the British minister. Both sides were impressed with Reza Khan's discipline and resolve, as well as his detachment from everyday politics and his display of political astuteness. No longer did his peasant and humble origins bother the class-conscious British diplomats who were accustomed to hobnobbing with refined members of Iranian nobility. The Soviet comrades, too, forgot that he had crushed the Janjal movement as soon as they discovered Reza Khan's proletariat origins and later the redeeming qualities of the national bourgeoisie. In what appeared to be a shrewd manoeuvre, Reza Khan resigned from the war ministry, only to be invited back by the Majlis. He reconciled with Modares, the Prince Regent, and the willing nobility, and even with the leader of the Majlis's ever-shrinking socialist faction, Soleiman Mirza. Martial law was suspended, the army budget was regulated, and momentarily there was hope for greater freedom of the press, yet this would prove to be only an interval. The one-year respite gave Reza Khan the chance to learn more, to consolidate his base, and to gather around him a capable cadre of civilians with vision. By October 1923, when Reza Khan formed his first government, with himself as the Prime Minister, he extended his power base beyond the military and presented a programme of reforms. He was backed by a public prepared to see him not as the rough-and-ready military commander, but as a national saviour who had pacified the country, secured its sovereignty, boosted national confidence, and pledged to fulfil Iran's long-awaited dreams of structural reforms. After 3 years of an effective presence on the political stage, it seemed almost inevitable that Reza Khan would entertain higher ambitions. There was very little, it appeared, that could stop him from claiming total control as the head of a republican state. After Ahmad Shah's departure for Europe, the fate of the Qajar monarchy was virtually sealed. The fourth Majlis had come to its end, and the election of the fifth Majlis, at least in part, was manipulated in such a way as to favour Reza Khan's ambitions, though it was still not clear in which fashion. With very few exceptions, the Iranian notables were willing collaborators, and large segments of the public were ready to accept a change in regime. In 1907, radicals among the constitutionalists advocated republicanism as an alternative to the Qajar dynastic rule, though soon they were marginalised by a conservative landowning elite and a clerical establishment that preferred monarchy, even a new Pahlavi monarchy, over a republic. By November 1923, the declaration of the Republic of Turkey, with Mustafa Kemal as its first president, deeply impressed the Iranian political milieu. The story of Kemal's departure from Istanbul in May 1919 to embark on an endeavour that eventually resulted in the creation of the new republic appealed to Reza Khan and his supporters, but also to the Iranian intelligentsia. Kemal Pasha was also an army officer, albeit trained in a military academy, a war hero, and a strong-willed leader with nationalist zeal who stood firmly against occupying armies and crushed secessionist tendencies. The parallel with Reza Khan was unmistakable. Not surprisingly, the first calls for the creation of an Iranian republic appeared in an Istanbul newspaper. Less than 3 months later, the abolition of the Qajar monarchy and the establishment of a republic was the first order on the agenda of the 5th Majlis. Thousands of telegrams, encouraged by pro-Reza Khan army commanders, were sent from the provinces urging the Majlis to act without delay. Indeed, in the days leading up to Nowruz festival, coinciding with March 21, 1924, the change in regime seemed likely to be ratified by the Majlis. And yet, the campaign eventually failed, causing Reza Khan a great loss of prestige. A grand coalition of pro-Qajar elements, led by Hassan Modarres and supported by remnants of the Qajar aristocracy loyal to the crown, the conservative preachers of the mosques, and liberal journalists afraid of Reza Khan's dictatorship, managed to kill off the Republican Commotion, as it came to be known. Fear of Reza Khan's dictatorial ambitions affected liberal intellectuals such as the poet Mirzadeh Eshki, the editor of the fiery newspaper Garne Bistoum, 20th century, who eventually paid with his own life for mocking the Republican campaign as a charade. In one of his popular songs, Tasnif, he wrote, "To ruin the land of the Persians, the agents of the aliens spread the word, put it in people's mouths. Republicanism is sweet, like the Indian sugar cane." But a voice from the invisible duly cautioned, "Republicanism is nothing but a sugar-coated sheep dropping. It is beautiful, it is attractive, but what appears in Republican clothing is bigotry and tyranny. Of this ugly clamour the motherland trembles, for it brought conflict and vengeance between the nation and the state. The chaste child of liberty is aborted at birth, and we forget even the name of unity." Yet what brought the Tehran public to the streets, via mosques, was in greater part the clergy's deep fears of Reza Khan's secularizing agenda. They reckoned that, like Mustafa Kemal in Turkey, Reza Khan's republicanism would establish a laic order hostile to the precepts of Islam and the Quran, allowing the atheists, the Baha'is, and other anti-Islamic elements to gain primacy. Manifold displays of irreligion in the public space terrified the mosque-going public and vindicated local preachers and their pleas to defend the Sharia against open displays of profanity, makeshift movie theatres, the earliest in Iran, screening Farangi silent one-reelers, taverns offering opium and home-brewed arak, musicians and dancers and storytellers narrating in coffeehouses the legends of the Shahnameh and the romances of Nizami's Seven Domes. Promiscuity and prostitution were available for the affluent, and popular painters depicted erotica from 1001 Nights. More men were appearing in European attire with beardless faces, and there were more mustachioed dandies wearing white shirts with detachable collars. Even daring women were appearing in lighter and less suffocating facial hijab. The greater visibility of the junior army officers in uniform, younger officials, and professionals educated in secular schools were also unwelcomed by the conservatives. They witnessed the young generation abandoning madrasa training, leaving behind clocks and turbans, shaving their beards, and putting on ties and Western-style suits to be government employees, defense lawyers, judges, tax collectors, journalists, or officials in registry offices. These were members of a new urban middle class who, though small in number, were distancing themselves from the old elite and their constituency. The landed notables, mojtahids, petty merchants, artisans, and shopkeepers of the bazaar, formed the backbone of the conservative sector. The multitudes of the poor, unemployed and downtrodden, were their foot soldiers, often frequenting mosques and pilgrimage sites and eking out a living at the margins of society with handouts from the mojtahids. On March 22, 1924, nearly 5,000 demonstrators gathered in Baharistan Square. The protesters were mostly bazaar merchants and members of the poor urban classes who came to demonstrate against heathen republicanism and its advocates and to show support for the constitutional monarchy. They clashed with the Tehran police and the auxiliary troops, and the subsequent shots fired over the crowd injured dozens and added to public fury. Reza Khan, who appeared in person to boost the morale of the security forces, was booed and missiles thrown at his carriage. Inside the Majlis, the speaker confronted him and, in a rare show of courage, rebuked him for breaching the parliamentary sanctuary. Shortly afterward, Modares, who was slapped in the face by a pro-Republic deputy on the floor of the Majlis, was able to capitalize on Reza Khan's haughtiness and his own aggrieved demeanor to carry a majority and defeat the proposed bill calling for establishment of the Republican regime. Reza Khan, dejected and furious, left the Majlis and, as a sign of his disapproval, left the capital for a village nearby. But soon thereafter he reassessed his options and sought an alternative route. Morales was a savvy manoeuvrer who had built for himself a reputation for honesty and frugality, a man of the people who lived simply, voiced the plight of the weak, and challenged excesses of the power. A master of persuasion, his common-sense parliamentary debates, in an unadulterated Isfahani accent, won him many admirers. He first rose to significance as a representative of the Najaf Mojtahids in the Third Majlis, but soon transformed himself into a consummate politician, guided more by realpolitik than by the dictates of Najaf. His rise typified a new kind of public figure who did not belong to the nobility, a man propelled to power by the constitutional revolution and kept there because of his public appeal. If Modares's opposition to establishing a republican regime was based on the best intentions, that he sensed the coming of a military dictatorship and moved against it, in the end, his recourse only helped monarchical autocracy to endure. It is questionable whether Modares's campaign to stop Reza Khan was entirely altruistic or merely a power grab, for there is little doubt that he held an alliance with reactionary mullahs in the city, the Lutis of Tehran's city quarters, the Qajar Prince Regent Muhammad Hassan Mirza, and the defeated Qajar nobility, who were anxious to preserve their privileges. What eventually allowed the opponent of republicanism to prevail, however, was Mustafa Kemal's abolition of the Islamic Caliphate in neighbouring Turkey. Between the demise of the Ottoman Sultanate in October 1923 and the end of the Caliphate on March 3, 1924, Kemal utilized his symbolic office to consolidate power over the Republic. After the Great War, Shi'i Iranians paid even less attention to the Sunni Caliphate, yet the fact that the new president of the Turkish Republic, a devout secularist, was able to abolish the much-augmented Caliphate may have suggested to the Shi'i Mojtahids that the same fate would await the clerical establishment should Reza Khan succeed in turning Iran into a republic. The uncanny parallel between Turkey and Iran scared the high-ranking Mojtahids in Najaf and in Iran. The strategy to rein in Reza Khan and defeat republicanism paid off at a time when public sentiments were high and the lethargic Qajar monarchy was still lingering. For a moment, it seemed as if Modares had succeeded in forcing Reza Khan to bow to the authority of the Majlis. But, as it turned out, he underestimated Reza Khan's resilience and overestimated his own popularity. 4 days after the demonstration of March the 22nd, Reza Khan made a pilgrimage to the shrine city of Qom, where he met with three grand ayatollahs of Najaf, who were temporarily residing there after having been deported from Iraq by the British mandatory authorities in the aftermath of the 1920 Shi'i revolt. Thankful to Reza Khan for negotiating with the British authorities for their safe return, they were willing to mediate a solution. After a closed-door meeting with the three Marjas, Reza Khan issued a public statement renouncing republicanism as unsuitable for Iran and assuring the public that he would focus on promoting Islam's prominence, Iran's sovereignty, and a nationalist government. Shortly thereafter, the three ayatollahs also issued a statement to all religious authorities, elites, merchants, guilds, and the rest of the Iranian nation, reiterating the undesirability of establishing a republic. Since there have been some utterances about establishing a republican regime that was not acquiesced to by the majority of the people and was incongruent with circumstances in this country, at the time when His Excellency the Prime Minister, may he be forever prominent, was visiting Qom, the abode of faith, to say farewell to us, we requested and he graciously accepted that this issue be obliterated and such debates abandoned, and an announcement to that effect be sent to all provinces. God willing, everyone would appreciate the value of such a blessing, and remain fully grateful for this benevolence. The three signatories were Abul Hassan Isfahani, 1860-1946, a marja with a large following, Muhammad Hassan Naini, the mojtahid who had previously produced the treatise on the compatibility of a constitutional regime with Shi'i idea of government, and Abdul Karim Ha'eri, 1859-1937, who was instrumental in developing Qom as a major centre for study of jurisprudence. Ha'eri would later be Ayatollah Khomeini's teacher and mentor. Despite all the negative publicity surrounding the Republican initiative then and later, that it was a backdoor to Reza Khan's dictatorship, contrary to Iranian political tradition and against Islam, its defeat proved a major loss for Iran's political future. It could be argued that Reza Khan's opting for a dynastic monarchy as an alternative to the republic only a year later perpetuated a long tradition of dynastic rule. It undermined the Majlis and crushed all sources of opposition, including Modares. Moreover, the Pahlavi hereditary succession in and of itself would be a major obstacle to long-term political change even after the fall of Reza Shah in 1941. Adopting a monarchy allowed the Pahlavi regime to bank on the historical tradition of Iranian kingship and earn for itself political legitimacy far beyond what a president of a republic, even a dictatorial one, could have done. In the course of the 16 months leading up to the abolition of the Qajar dynasty and the investiture of Reza Shah Pahlavi in December 1925, the political climate noticeably shifted in favour of Reza Khan and his drive toward the Persian throne. In July 1924, the minority in the Majlis, headed by Modares and supported by, among others, the poet and Majlis deputy, Muhammad Taghi Bahar, held a vote of no confidence in the government on the grounds of the unconstitutionality of Reza Khan's conduct in office, disrespect for the Majlis, mistreatment of citizens, and financial misappropriation. Yet their manoeuvre was defeated by a vast margin. In a short period, the climate had dramatically changed against Modares and his supporters. Fearing intimidation, physical attacks, and threats to their life from agents of Reza Khan's police and their hired thugs, members of the dwindling minority did not feel safe even taking their seats in the Majlis. Bahar, who earlier had welcomed the rise of Reza Khan, but soon became one of his eloquent critics, expressed the mixed feelings that intellectuals of the period reserved for the emerging dictator. In one of his masterpieces, Damovandiye, on Damovand, also known as Enchained White Demon, composed in 1922, he calls on the highest summit of the Elburz Range, Mount Damovand, overlooking Tehran, to burst open on the Iranian capital and destroy its sinful inhabitants. Once an active volcano, Damovand is the centre of Iran's mythological geography in the Shahnameh. Bahar writes, "O Damovand, the enchained white demon, the dome of the world, you, the heavy fist of the time, untouched by the passage of time, rise to the heavens and blow on the land of Ray a few times. From the fire of the oppressed and flame of divine punishment, send clouds over the land of Ray. Rain fear, war, and terror, like fire and brimstone that blow Sodom to oblivion, like the city of Pompeii that Vulcan brought to instant death. Destroy the pillars of this deceit, tore apart this race and this kinship. Take the revenge of the wise from these ignoble idiots." Calling on the enchained white demon is an obvious double entendre, for it is an allusion not only to the volcano's white cap, but also to the white demon killed by Rostam in the seven trials he undertook in Mozandaran. The white demon can be taken as an allusion to the Janjal movement and the Bolshevik support for it that was eventually brought to an end by Reza Khan. That is all the more plausible since the mythical Damovand also holds inside the tyrant Zahak of the Shahnameh, who usurped Jamshid's throne and ruled over Iran for a millennium before the hero-saviour Fereydun eternally chained him on Mount Damovand. It is as though here Bahar were making a second reference to Reza Khan, who has turned into a tyrant. Moreover, in Bahar's poem, Damovand is portrayed as the dome of the Giti, the Iranian mythological goddess of the fast-revolving terrestrial universe with fatalistic potency. She nurtures, then destroys humans and civilizations. The reincarnated Zahak, therefore, is destined by the fortune of the Giti to make his climb to absolute power before an inevitable fall. The volcanic task that the poet thus invites Damovand to perform is to destroy the old Qajar order and whatever is associated with it, just as Zahak was invited to overthrow Jamshid's once glorious but fast decaying kingdom. Despite its apparent pessimism, Bahar's complex imagery makes sense only if the unleashed Zahak of Damavand is to be seen as the lesser of the two evils, but one that is also destined for eventual destruction. Later, in October 1925, on the eve of the abolition of the Qajar dynasty, Bahar's criticism of Reza Khan almost cost him his life. In a case of mistaken identity, the plainclothes henchmen of the new regime assassinated in front of the Majlis an unfortunate person who resembled Bahar. The other deputies got the message. Landing in Reza Shah's jail a few years later, Bahar got the message. He gave up politics and became a renowned professor of Persian literature in Tehran University. One of the 20th century's greatest students of Persian culture, he was far from the revolutionary fire of his youth, though not devoid of the modern values that shaped his generation. The Imbri Affair and the Display of Religiosity. What would come to be known as the Imbri Affair, or Sagorkhaneh incident, embarrassing as it was for the Iranian government, greatly contributed to the atmosphere of fear and intimidation and may have struck the final blow to Reza Khan's opposition. In July 1924, Tehran was abuzz with reports of a miracle in a water fountain, Sagorkhaneh, where the sick would be cured and wishes granted. This would have been a familiar occurrence in Shi'i Iran had it not been for the fact that it fit too well with the struggles between Reza Khan and his opponents to be seen merely as a coincidence. It was rumoured that a Baha'i who had refused to pay a customary donation to the sacred fountain had instantaneously gone blind, but once he repented his heretical beliefs and paid the tribute, he was immediately cured. The story of the Blessed Fountain had its political beneficiaries and was likely orchestrated from Reza Khan's quarters. Greater social freedom since 1921 no doubt had given the Baha'i a degree of visibility, and Reza Khan was accused of favouring them. Now that the crypto-Azali radicals of the constitutional era were no more, the Baha'is briefly came to offer a moderate path to modernity, one in tune with the emerging Pahlavi order. A long history of anti-Baha'i campaigns made such a design plausible, though not perhaps its unintended results. Reza Khan's agents probably hoped for a short and manageable uproar to display his loyalty to Shi'ism, dispel the rumours of his anti-Islamic project of reforms, and possibly even set the stage for reinstating martial law. Yet the episode brought about serious consequences. Among the growing number of onlookers who visited the now sacred fountain was the acting consul of the U.S. legation in Tehran, Robert Imbri, who also freelanced as a journalist for the National Geographical Society. Imbri was not a professional diplomat but a special agent, a maverick with strong anti-Bolshevik credentials. An Indiana Jones of sorts, he was a graduate of the 1906 Yale Law School and a protege of Alan Dulles, the future head of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency in the 1950s. Imbri was dispatched to Iran by the U.S. State Department to facilitate the implementation of an ongoing oil concession between an American company and the Iranian government. Sinclair Oil, the first American attempt to explore oil in Iran's Caspian shores, had faced serious opposition from the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, which considered Iranian oil as its exclusive tenure. Hoping to make an illustrated report out of miracle-making water fountain, a piece of Oriental exotica no doubt appealing to the readers of the National Geographic, Imbri set up his camera near the site. But he soon faced angry bystanders' objections to an infidel's photographing what had become a sacred site. Mayhem broke out, in the course of which Imbri and his associate were deliberately beaten and bruised. With the help of some bystanders, they managed to reach the carriage that had brought them to the scene and headed for the hospital. But quite inexplicably, the carriage was stopped by a police officer on duty. Later, when they were brought to the government hospital for treatment, Imbri was followed by a group of thugs who soon entered the operating room and resumed beating and stabbing him in the presence of policemen. He died shortly after. The ugly incident generated an outcry. Several arrests were made, presumably the culprits were later executed, and the Iranian government accepted making monetary compensation, but it never became clear if the incident was a fantastic mob outburst perpetrated against the American diplomat or against the Baha'is, or more likely a manoeuvre orchestrated by Reza Khan's agents that had gotten out of hand. Whatever the case, the incident allowed Reza Khan to declare martial law and round up more of his critics. They had become vocal, especially after the assassination of the dissident poet and journalist Mirzadeh Eshqi, whose assassination was also traceable to Reza Khan's police. With martial law again in place, opponents were arrested or silenced. The Imbri affair also allowed Reza Khan to outmaneuver Arthur Millspaugh, the American financial advisor to the Iranian government, who was soon forced to resign. Millspaugh had resisted allocating all the revenue that the Iranian government earned from APOC concessions to the Iranian armed forces. By doing so, he outraged Reza Khan, who relied heavily on that revenue to reorganize the army and consolidate his hold over the political establishment and the country. The Imbri affair served to cast off the stigma of irreligion from Reza Khan. Not long before the night of Ashura mourning ceremonies during Muharram, 1343, August 1924, Reza Khan, accompanied by some senior officers, joined the procession of the Night of the Bereaved, Shamma Gariban. Clad in black, candles in hand, and beating his chest, he recited along with the mourners tragic verses about the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his family. In another show of devotion, then Premier Reza Khan received from the shrine of Ali in Najaf a medallion portrait of the first Imam. It was offered as a token of gratitude on behalf of the two Ayatollahs upon their safe arrival in Najaf. The medallion, a 19th-century rendering, was presented to Reza Khan with pomp and circumstance, in a ceremony reminiscent of Nasser ad-Din Shah's investiture of an Ali decoration 70 years earlier on the occasion of his ephemeral victory in Herat. It was as if Reza Khan were toying with the idea of kingship. In search of legitimacy. Having learned his lesson from the Republican campaign, Reza Khan acted with greater circumspection. In an effort to acquire public confidence and greater legitimacy during his second term in office, he even acquiesced to the minority in the Majlis. He and his cohorts, civilian and military alike, not only displayed Islamic sentiments, but also began to borrow from historical memory and Persian nationalist icons that were prevalent during and after the Constitutional Revolution. Persian legendary and historical memories were powerful tools for augmenting the Pahlavi image. By 1924, the pro-Reza Khan press routinely depicted their hero as a second Nader Shah, a savior who emerged at Iran's darkest hour, drove out the foreign invaders, pacified rebellions, reunited the country, and successfully pursued a program of reform. Like Nader, Reza Khan was of humble origins, and his determination, military gifts, and sharp mind outshone the weaknesses of his enemies and allowed him to outmaneuver restive Khans, bandits, and rebels. It did not take long before new pre-Islamic royal figures complemented Reza Khan's heroic image. References to the Achaemenid, Cyrus the Great, and Darius, Dara in Persian sources of the period, also prevalent in the post-constitutional literature, accompanied references to Reza Khan in newspaper articles and books. His public statements also relied on the revived memories of the rulers of the 5th century BC to augment his new age of revival. Crafting his own image after these glorious narratives of Iran's distant past, a notable feature of the emergent Pahlavi era, made Reza Khan and his modernist project appear wholly distinct from the ethos of the Qajar era. The constitutional revolution had already turned the Qajar monarchy and its Turkic-Mongolian roots into a liability, an image of alien rule, despotism, and weakness. The new Pahlavi power, in contrast, invoked the ancient Iranian past. A gradual shift from myth to history, from legends of the Shahnameh to the modern description of the Achaemenid and Sasanian empires, was grounded in archaeological discoveries and greater knowledge of ancient Greek texts, which boosted public awareness and national pride. As early as 1914, a decade before the rise of Pahlavi dynasty, Iranian postal stamps, a public marker of nationalist sentiment, showed Darius I on his throne under the Zoroastrian Faravahar insignia. Another scene of Persepolis showed Tachara, the residential palace of the Achaemenid kings. Such publications as the Berlin-based periodical Kaveh, edited by Hassan Taghizadeh and his associate, the gifted short story writer Muhammad Ali Jamalzadeh, contributed to Iran's budding cultural nationalism. With centralization at its core, the nationalist awareness promoted by the Berlin Circle anticipated the rise of a strong state. Hassan Mushir el-Dowleh's 1927 Iran-e Bastani, Ancient Iran, the first of several versions of his canonical history of Iran's pre-Islamic past, is a notable example of a metamorphosis from legendary kings of the Kayanid dynasty in the Shahnameh to the Persian Empire of Herodotus and the Achaemenid dynasty of the archaeological digs. The new Pahlavi potentate strived to be the apex of this reconstructed historical pyramid. The Majlis passed a new bill in 1925, abolishing all Qajar titles and in favor of adopting family names through a national registry, a novel idea for Iranians and the first of several measures that augmented the state's power over its own citizenry. First and last names fixed citizens with a clear personal identity that was only implicitly, if at all, connected with their paternalistic lineage. New family names were meant to be short and simple. For the nobility, they were often much shorter versions of their Qajar titles. Others identified themselves by their ethnic, tribal, clan, or family identity, and others by their father's first name, their town or village origin, their profession, a chosen virtue, or by nationalist, religious, or other real or imagined affiliations. The abolition of titles was a further blow to the old class system, for it removed symbols of proximity to power, giving the appearance of a more egalitarian society. Reza Khan himself adopted the family name Pahlavi, presumably a variation of Pahlani, the name of his subtribe in the Savadku region. As a family name, however, Pahlani had an unfortunate association with Palan, a cargo saddle for beasts of burden, especially donkeys, whereas Pahlavi clearly resonated with a pre-Islamic past, specifically an aristocratic clan of the Sasanian period. Even more edifying, Pahlavi was a general reference to the Middle Persian of the Sasanian period and the written culture in that language. Mentioned in the Shahnameh, the word Pahlavi evoked historical continuity, particularly since Pahlavi was still in use as the liturgy language of Zoroastrians of Iran and their Parsi co-religionists in India. Modern scholarship of pre-Islamic Iranian languages in Europe largely recovered Pahlavi texts and resolved their many ambiguities. A glorious, though vague, association with the Iranian past, Pahlavi became the name of the new dynasty. Beyond hearsay and from the newspapers on his payroll, Reza Khan came to learn more about Iran's past, its history and culture, in the months before his accession to the throne. For a while, a group of erudite Majlis deputies were invited to meet with him on a regular basis to discuss the idea and practice of constitutionalism, political and international affairs, and programs of reform, as well as to allow Reza Khan to absorb more of Iran's long history and geography. Among them was the aforementioned Hassan Mushir el-Dowleh, now with the family name Pirniya, who had wisely given up on politics for scholarship. Others included Yahya Dowlatabadi, 1862-1940, a leading constitutionalist of prominent Azali background, and later a gifted memoirist, and Mohammad Mossadegh, 1882-1967, a Swiss-educated lawyer and member of the Qajar nobility. For a while, The advisory group met with Reza Khan in the spirit of mutual understanding. While the participants hoped to nurture in him a commitment to constitutional principles, he evidently aimed to appease the Majlis's liberal opposition, if not co-opted. The informal advisory group, however, failed to instill in the ambitious Reza Khan a lasting love for democracy or much respect for the constitution. Efforts to educate him succeeded only in allowing Iran's strongman to articulate a nationalist vision of his own, of territorial integrity, centralized and effective state power, independent foreign policy, and a program of cultural reconstruction. Once they were dismissed as a group and then individually snubbed into isolation, they began to recognize, along with a vast majority of constitutionalists, that the Pahlavi path to absolute power was at the point of no return. Most resigned to this inevitability and hoped for its benevolence, while only a few resisted. Reclaiming Khuzestan. One outcome of the Pahlavi show of patriotic resolve was the Khuzestan campaign in the fall of 1924. It boosted Reza Khan's prestige and reasserted control over this oil-rich but otherwise isolated and impoverished province. Also known as Arabistan in the Qajar era, Khuzestan was a sparsely populated land with few urban centres, virtually no major agriculture except for palm groves, and a large minority population that spoke an Arabic dialect common to the northwestern coasts of the Persian Gulf. Organised into a tribal system, the Banu Kab and Banu Taf were the most powerful Arab confederacies in Khuzestan. At least since the 18th century, they had been active as a political player in the region. The interior highlands were the Bakhtiari winter resort and a vital asset for the confederacy's pastoral economy. In between the quarrelling chiefs of Banu Taf and Banu Kab and the competing branches of the Bakhtiari, there was limited space for Tehran's presence in cities such as the ancient Shashtar, Dezful, and Ahvaz. Most initiatives to penetrate Khuzestan since the 18th century and attempts to develop it since the 19th century had failed because of a scarcity of resources and technology. The port of Nazariye, south of Ahvaz, later named Bandar-e-Sherpur under Pahlavi rule, and Bandar-e-Khomeini under the Islamic Republic, was one exception. It had been developed under Nasiruddin Shah as an alternative to the strategically vulnerable port of Mohammara and to compete with the Ottoman port of Basra. Nasiriyeh was also the home port for Persepolis, Iran's only battleship in the Qajar era. Since the 1880s, the interiors of Khuzestan were somewhat revived as a result of the British-operated Lynch Navigation Company, which operated a steamboat service on the River Karun, Iran's only navigable river, from Mohammara, some 140 miles north, to Shustar. From there, construction of Shustar-Isfahan commercial road through Bakhtiari lands opened up the hard-to-access Iranian countryside to the southwest of Isfahan for the first time. The Anglo-Persian oil exploration, moreover, proved a major factor in changing the province's economic and political landscape. The Masjid Suleiman oil fields were in Bakhtiari territory, whereas the newly built Abadan refinery, which by the 1930s would be the largest in the world, fell within the Banu Kab territory on the eastern shore of Shatt al-Arab. Tehran's campaign to reclaim Khuzestan, under the initial pretext of collecting taxes in arrears, naturally alarmed the British, APOC, and chiefs of the Banu Kab. London felt that Tehran's ambition to administer Khuzestan directly would spoil its careful arrangements with the Bakhtiari and Bani Kab, who had been granted minuscule shares of the oil revenue in exchange for land use, security, and labour. Bakhtiari tribesmen were employed at the oil rigs with negligible wages as oil workers or as guards, and they were treated with little mercy. The growing influence and wealth of Sheikh Khazal of Al-Lemasin, the chief of the Banu Kab, was but one example of the transformation of tribal chiefs of the Shatt al-Arab and Mohammara regions under British auspices. A shrewd manoeuvrer, Khazal colluded with APOC, along with some Bakhtiari and Lur chiefs, in the hopes of finding a common front against Tehran's advances. By November 1924, the cavalry and armoured columns of the Iranian army ventured toward Khuzestan in a pincer movement through Luristan and Isfahan, which already were pacified. With great speed, the government forces managed to occupy Ahvaz, remove Khaz'al, and capture the entire province. Once their mediatory efforts failed, the British bowed to Tehran's daring measure. They were assured that British hold over the oil fields and the oil industry, then one of the most profitable oil operations in the world, was secure. The assurances were confirmed by Reza Khan's action. Khaz'al's efforts to coordinate with Reza Khan's opposition in Tehran through Modares, among other channels, also failed, and Khaz'al was forced to take back his bold disowning of Reza Khan and his claims that he was a usurper who undermined the country's constitution and illegally seized power. Khaz'al was sent off to Tehran, and soon his wealth and property were confiscated. Reclaiming Khuzestan marked the last stage of moving away from the concept of the guarded domains of Iran toward the centralizing, sublime state of Iran, Dolat Aliyeh Iran. That the British condoned the Pahlavi centralization program is astonishing, given their enormous diplomatic and military presence only 4 years earlier. The change of heart was understandable, given that the British inadvertently discovered in the new regime some fulfillment of the 1919 agreement, at least insofar as it created a centralized military capable of securing Britain's investment and strategic interests, albeit in the hands of a nationalist moderniser. Reza Khan was not entirely of their making, but he was not entirely opposed to their vested interests either. In the months following Curzon's departure, the Foreign Office quickly condoned a utilitarian policy of accommodating the new Iranian regime. Even when Reza Khan postured to capture the Persian crown, the British bowed to his ambition. They abandoned their pledge since 1828 to keep the Qajar House on the throne. They complied not only because Reza Khan's rise proved irresistible, and because he dislodged within the Iranian polity most agents of British influence, the so-called Anglophiles, but also because he offered a reliable bulwark against the Soviet threat. Even before the fall of the Janjal movement, Reza Khan had managed to establish friendly relations with the Soviet legation. Later, during the campaign for republicanism, he even instructed some of his trusted military and civilian supporters to surreptitiously hoist a few red flags in the style of the Bolsheviks. Yet his anti-communist credentials were intact, and that is what mattered most for British interests at a time when there seemed to be no viable Russian party with whom the British could negotiate Iran's status as a buffer state. The Great War in retrospect. More than at any time in its modern history, during World War I and its aftermath, Iran was affected by the military, economic, and human repercussions of a global conflict. Iran was incorporated deep enough into a geopolitical system not to be able to ignore threats to its neutrality or to weather conflicting imperial pressures on its borders. Despite such threats, however, the Iranian state survived heavy blows to its sovereignty. This was all the more remarkable because the decade-long upheavals between 1911 and 1921 not only revealed serious rifts in the ruling elite, but also brought about the Qajar monarchy's eventual demise. The war also brought into light political players, intellectuals, and military officers who were the product of the constitutional revolution. It was to the credit of this mix of the old and new classes, rather than the goodwill of the occupying powers, that Iran barely avoided partition along the lines set in the 1907 Anglo-Russian agreement. Despite obvious limits to its authority and its effectiveness, and despite all its failings, the Iranian state managed to navigate the stormy waters of the war period and its aftermath through diplomacy and political maneuvering. If there was a single event beyond its borders that saved Iran, it was the destruction of the Russian Empire. Remarkably, before 1921, none of the nationalist-inspired movements that hoped to liberate Iran from foreign occupation and from the declining Qajar elite succeeded in their task. The government in exile of the Committee for National Defense, German covert operations inside Iran and the Berlin Resistance Circle, and subsequently the Janjal movement in Gilan and the nationalist rebellions in Khorasan and Azerbaijan failed, while the centre continued to hold a degree of legitimacy and political agency. The Iranian state employed its meagre financial resources, including revenue from the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, and its limited military capabilities, such as the Cossack Division and the Gendarmerie after 1918, to withstand secessionist challenges. In despair, the ruling elite also subscribed to a half-hearted British effort to resuscitate the Qajar state. Yet the nationalist polity took advantage of the international uproar to successfully resist the semi-protectorate status that the 1919 Anglo-Persian Agreement offered. Its failure paved the way for the rise of a rough-and-ready strongman in the person of Reza Khan. He and the Cossack Division under his command came to the rescue of the central state by systematically quashing the rebellious periphery. The implicit blessing of the British representatives, and shortly after the consent of the Bolsheviks, upheld the new regime and its drive for state building. In retrospect, Reza Khan's consolidation between 1921 and 1925 appeared as an unavoidable outcome of World War I, a price that Iran had to pay to conclude two decades of political revolution, economic vacillation, and socio-cultural change.